them in the text in Bhagavad Gita, or if one follows them in the course of one's life, one, the opportunity is there, at least, to come to the topmost form of yoga, uttama. So, in chapter 3, it's one of the stages of yoga, karma yoga. Yesterday we discussed unregulated life, life that's regulated by the process of the Vedic wisdom, rituals, karmakanda rituals, for the purpose of material elevation, and the performance of duties in varnashram, and then the dedication of the fruits of those activities in varnashram unto the Supreme, with a desire of some way profiting, sakam karma yoga, nishkam karma yoga, and then bhakti yoga. We discussed that from the verses of Bhagavad Gita. So immediately, I want two main things I want to cover this evening. One, besides that little review, one is according to the language that follows that verse where bhakti yoga is made its distinction from nishkam karma yoga, namely its consciousness. When one has proper Krishna consciousness, that is, sanyas yad yatma chetasa, one's consciousness is fixed upon the self in a spiritual conception, and the goal is also fixed upon the Supreme Person as the real shelter and goal of one's life, it doesn't mean that one stops activity, or I'll say it in the positive, one continues one's activity. And the activity that one continues is, naturally, it's according to one's nature. Each of us has a body, and according to the embodiment that we have a particular nature. Guna and karma, Krishna says in the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Chatur Varnamaya Shrishtam Guna Karma Vibhagashaha. Krishna has Shrishta, he has created this system of divisions of labor according to our nature. This nature means conditioned nature. It's not our higher spiritual nature, but we have duties to do according to our embodiment, our conditioned nature. And Krishna explains, in this stage of bhakti yoga, because we discussed the bhakti yoga principle, those persons who execute their duties according to my injunctions and who follow this teaching faithfully without envy become free from the bondage of fruitive actions. Let's go over that again. The impetus for karma yoga in the preliminary stage is knowledge. Knowledge that says, if I engage in work on this plane, the material plane, whatever I do, there's bondage. And I can't refrain from doing something even for a moment because I'm spirit soul. And spirit souls are always active, so I always have to be doing something. I can't refrain from doing something, even for a moment. So that's not a solution. Doing nothing. And if I do something, there's bondage. So what to do? Sacrifice. Yajna. Sacrifice unto Vishnu is the solution. That's what's recommended in the beginning parts of the third chapter. So what's the purpose? The inspiration or the motive behind offering the fruits of one's work unto the Supreme to release one from the bondage of what we have to do simply because we have a body. There's a spirit soul animating it. We have to do something and there's bondage. So, release from bondage. Sakkam. Karma yoga. I have the desire to achieve release from bondage. And nishkam, karma yoga. I simply have the desire to be situated in my natural activity without attachment to the fruits of work. And bhakti is my consciousness is fixed upon the Supreme. So one who is in this consciousness, the verse we just read, Krishna says, automatically, it's a subset. That's a nice math term. There's sets. Those of you that you studied sets yet in school in math? Sets? No? Okay. Here there's like a group, and then there's sets that are within a group, and then there's subsets. So here's the simple way. Prabhupada said, if you have $1 million, your $100 and $10 problems are solved. Because the $10 problems, they're a subset. The $100 problems, they're a subset. If you have $1 million, you take care of it. No problem. It's already taken care of. If you attain, similarly, if you attain bhakti, then the subset is already attained. That subset is detachment or getting released from the fruits of one's work. Moksha or liberation is already included. You don't have to try for liberation. You don't need to aspire for liberation. It's included. Clear? That liberation specifically is detachment from the fruits of one's work. Not aspiring for the fruits of one's work. We read that yesterday. Nor, if the fruit of the work comes, trying to be the enjoyer of that. The proprietor and enjoyer of it. There's a nice verse in the Bhagavatam that says the same thing. Dharma should be taken up for the purpose of ultimate liberation. Dharmasya hi apavargasya narto tayo pakalpate. One shouldn't take up dharma for the purpose of sense gratification. One should not take up dharma for the purpose of improving one's material condition. Commonly that's called artha, economic development. Say it one more time. Dharma is not to be taken up for the purpose of achieving material prosperity. In the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, that's what most people do. By and large, that's what most people do. And it's within the Purushartha. Dharma artha, kama moksha. Yes? The purpose of most people, vishaya, Trigunya vishaya veda. The purpose of the Vedas, the message of the Vedas, largely, is vishaya, trigunya. Vishaya means enjoyment. How to be a pious enjoyer within this world. Because if you're pious, you'll achieve punya, piety. What's the purpose of piety? You prosper. And when you prosper, you enjoy. So, be pious. Do dharma, so you get piety. And with that pious credit, you'll prosper and you'll enjoy. And after this life, you go to the heavenly realm, svarga, and you'll enjoy millions of times more. It's a big upgrade. Bhagavatam says, never aspire for that through the purpose of dharma. Narto tayopa kalpate. There's one thing that one should aspire for. Krishna shelter. Ultimate liberation. Not the merging into Brahman kind of liberation. Rather being eternally situated in loving service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That should be one's aspiration through Dharma. And then it's like checkmate. Supposing you're a nice devotee and you are doing your devotional service, your sadhana, bhakti, as nicely as you can. And that's also earning you some pious credit. You didn't do it for that purpose, but look what just came. Some knock on the door and here comes prosperity. Some opportunity. Here's some wealth. Here's some position. Here's some recognition. Here's some honor. Here's some fame. Here's some glory. Here's the fruit of your devotional service, the pious merit portion of your devotional service. Now what are you supposed to do? The Bhagavatam says, never should that be employed in sense gratification. Rather, that should also be used simply in the service of the Supreme. Nartasya dharmai kantasya kamo labhaya hi smritaha. So that's the Bhagavatam language, and now we're back to Bhagavad Gita. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is saying here, text 31, if one follows this principle, that is, you act according to your nature, but the consciousness behind that action is that the Supreme should be pleased. And you're maintaining that spiritual conception throughout the course of your activity. Automatically. You're not bound to any kind of fruitive result of that activity. Not trying to be an enjoyer. Not trying to be the proprietor. That is all left behind on the strength of bhakti. It is far better to... Then there's one other verse. I wanted to spend some time with this. Even a man of knowledge acts according to his own nature. For everyone follows the nature he has acquired from the three modes. What can repression accomplish? What this verse is not speaking about, sometimes I just want to flag it. What it's not speaking about is the Freudian kind of repression. Because language is a... All that language is it's a symbol. One of the things that I like about Sanskrit is I don't know Sanskrit. And so when I hear a Sanskrit word, I have to like assign a meaning to it that doesn't already... Because I don't have any meaning. It's just... It's a new word. And that's... It's very nice, because especially hearing Srila Prabhupada using the word again and again from this angle, that angle, that angle, then it has like a very clear meaning. It's just a symbol of something. It's a message or an essence or a tattva, a subject that's important for spiritual life to be understood. So this word, similarly, repression, in our modern use of the English word, it's connected to a term that Sigmund Freud used. Repression, he used in relation to sex desire, or he used a nice Latin word, libido. And what you shouldn't repress your sex desire or other desires. You should use it. Liberally, because otherwise you'll have a psychological problem. You're a repressed person. That was his use of the term. So because of that Western use of the term, sometimes devotees read this verse and understand wrongly. What Krishna is saying is we shouldn't repress our sex desire. Or we shouldn't repress other forms of material desire. That's not what it's speaking about. What it's speaking about is prescribed duties. Specifically to Arjuna, Arjuna is thinking, the consideration of fighting this battle looks so horrific to me. Better that I just stop being a Kshatriya and become a mendicant instead. Because according to Kshatriya codes, they have their means of maintenance. What's their means of maintenance? They give protection, they rule, and those who they rule over and who are protected, they provide taxes for the king or the governing person, and that's the maintenance of the king or the Kshatriya. So what Krishna had done was, in order to secure a peace offer, he went to the Kauravas and said, the Pandavas are the rightful heir of the throne. They are entitled to the throne. You keep the throne. Just give them 5 states to rule over. They'll be under you. They'll pay tribute to you, and you'll be the emperor. But give them 5 states so they can maintain themselves and give protection. No. Well, give them 5 cities. No. Give them 5 villages. No. So, although they're entitled to the entire world kingdom, not even 5 villages. So if they can't even rule 5 villages without a fight, Arjuna's saying, I'll stop being a Kshatriya. I'll maintain myself just by begging. I'll be a mendicant. Krishna's saying, what good will repression accomplish? The failure to execute your prescribed duties as a means of getting out of the implication and complication of material life, that's not a solution. It's not a viable solution. Because, as he's saying, whether one is in ignorance or is in knowledge, in complete knowledge, if one is in knowledge and neglects to perform prescribed duty, you're implicated. There's sinful reaction for failure to carry out your prescribed duty according to your nature. That's what it means. Because that's what Arjuna wanted to do. He was like, I'm out of here. I'll just go live in a cave, go into the mountains, become a mendicant. I'll just stop being a Kshatriya. Karma sannyas is the Sanskrit term. And Krishna's saying, you don't have that qualification, Arjuna. You have a nature. You're a warrior. You'll be sitting in that cave thinking, that rascal Duryodhana. Because you have a nature. You're a Kshatriya. You must act according to your nature. What good will repression accomplish? If you don't perform your prescribed duty, that's the repression. Stop the reaction by stopping action. It's not possible. That's what his message means. Clear? Maybe you haven't heard that use of the term. Stay around the Hare Krishna movement for a while and you will. Maybe it's not, you know, the practicing devotees, but maybe the marginal devotees or those that have some other version of Bhagavad Gita besides this one. It will be helpful for you to understand what that means going into the future. So, because there is a tendency of the conditioned soul to try to be the enjoyer. That's why we're here. The imitation Purusha. Because we try to be the enjoyer, we have that concept, that consciousness. Attachment develops to objects. And that attachment to material objects bewilders the mind of the conditioned soul, and that bewilderment state of mind prevents one from thinking of Krishna, prevents one from sitting peacefully and chanting Krishna's holy name every morning, because the mind is going here and going there on towards the objects that we have some attraction or attachment for. So then the last section of the chapter, I just want to summarize it. This is the other part I wanted to speak about. Arjuna asks a very important question that we should be aware of what the answer to the question is. He asks, this is all very nice discrimination, good understanding. But sometimes we find ourselves having a clear understanding of what's to be done, something that we would really benefit from if we did it, and we don't do it. Or the other way around, something we know we would really benefit from if we didn't do it. We've think it through very carefully, considered from different angles, scriptural authority. Yes, this is something that I should rid myself of. And we find ourselves doing it again and again. But why? Arjun wants to know, why is that? As if engaged by force, we will something and we do something else. Why? So Krishna gives a very, very straightforward answer. Krishna gives a question. Krishna gives a very straightforward answer. He says, when in contact with the mode of passion, rajoguna, then lust arises, kama. And from kama comes krodha, or anger. Which is the all-devouring sinful enemy of the world. Then he gives three metaphors. It's in descending order. As fire is covered by smoke, as a mirror is covered by dust, and as an embryo is covered by the womb, so every living entity is covered by different degrees of lust. So he, Prabhupada in the purport, explains the examples. The embryo covered by the womb is in a very confined condition. The living entity in the womb of the mother can't even move, what to speak of, in a very tight, uncomfortable posture. So that's compared to a living entity in the body of a tree, so confined you can't move. Or a mirror covered by dust is compared to beasts and birds. There's more freedom, but one can't quite see the self because the mirror is covered by the dust. Or smoke covering fire. This is the human form of life, because just next to spiritual consciousness is intelligence. In the purport, Prabhupada calls it the next door neighbor of the soul. That's a water tower, or that way. The next door neighbor of the soul is intelligence. So through the agency of human advanced consciousness, even more specifically, brahminical consciousness, or striving to discern the distinction between matter and spirit and becoming clear of what the identity of spirit is. Not just believing that there's a soul, but having a very clear, conscious conception of the soul, like was described in the previous verses. Adhyatma Chetasa. That fire may be covered by smoke. So what you want to do with fire is handle the fuel and the oxygen very carefully so there's no smoke. It's just strong flame. And that's what we're doing. We're trying to do. Take that human intelligence, the more proximate position of to the soul, and refine it. Finer, 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 so that we're directly conscious of the soul and the Supreme Soul, and the relationship of the individual soul and the Supreme Soul. Thus, the wise living entity, in pure consciousness, becomes covered by his eternal enemy in the form of lust, which is never satisfied and burns like fire. There's one sannyasi I know that really likes this verse. He quotes it a lot. Avritam gyanam etena gyanino nitya vairina kama rupena kaunteya dushparena nalena cha.
It's painful. That's passion. In the beginning, it looks nice. But in the end, it burns like fire. Very painful. Passion ends up like that. In the beginning, it doesn't look like that. But that's where it takes you. And then, there's different sitting places of lust. Again, in ascending order, the senses, the mind, and the intelligence. Even the intelligence can be moved by the mode of passion or lusty. And lusty intelligence enables the conditioned soul to make arrangements for sense gratification and become so entangled they can't get out. It takes intelligence, takes material intelligence to accomplish that. And modern society is very accomplished with material intelligence, making such an entangling web. People are so attached. And become so frustrated and angry when their hopes to become enjoyers fail. There's so much anger in this world. Wars and outbreaks, and as Prabhupada describes over and over again, man's inhumanity to man. So crass all over the place. It's the mode of passion that later transforms to wrath. So what Krishna is advising is regulation helps one overcome that tendency. It gives strength so that the pushing of the mode of passion or lust can't act. It may even push, but it can't act. It's like reducing the smoke from the fire, or clearing the dust from the mirror, or releasing the living entity from the womb, allowing the freedom, the natural freedom that's desired by all living entities, to become manifest. But as long as we want freedom, but as long as it's a sense of independence of the Supreme, there's more bondage. It's exactly the opposite. One that wants unrestricted independence and freedom becomes more bound by the complexities of material nature. And the opposite, one who places himself in the position of giving submission and attention and dependence upon the Supreme, their freedom increases and increases and increases, unlimitedly. We're still bound, but we're bound by love rather than by the restrictive forces of material nature, passion and ignorance especially. So that's a very special gift, freedom from bondage. And Krishna is offering the means. Therefore, O Arjuna, best of the Bharatas, in the very beginning, curb this great symbol of sin, lust, by regulating the senses, and slay the destroyer of knowledge and self-realization. The working senses are superior to dull matter. Mind is higher than the senses. Intelligence is still higher than the mind. And he, the soul, is even higher than the intelligence, in the last verse of the chapter. Thus knowing oneself to be transcendental to the material senses, mind, and intelligence, O mighty armed Arjuna, one should steady the mind by deliberate spiritual intelligence. Again, this is the same word that was used, or term. Again, a nice Sanskrit term that for me, I don't know what the meaning is, so just hearing it used again and again in different ways, it makes the meaning very clear. Buddhi, spiritual intelligence, is distinct from material intelligence. Material intelligence binds one in material complexity. Just like in the Bhagavatam. This is the Bhagavad Gita message. We'll go to the Bhagavatam where it's explained in the form of a history. So in the history of the lineages of kings from King Uttanapada, there was one king, Puchinibhari. So Uttanapada and his son Dhruva and the whole line of kings from Uttanapada, they were all great devotees. And they all had the same spiritual master, Narada Muni. So Narada Muni had a lot of compassion upon King Uttanapada and his descendants. And one in that line kind of went off track a little bit. He was a devotee, but he had too much mixed interest in material enjoyments. And so he involved himself, indulged himself extensively in karmakanda rituals. So Narada decided to pay him a visit. And he didn't right away give him transcendental knowledge, saying, you know, King Puchinibhari, wake up. You're asleep. Get up early and perform your sadhana bhakti. He didn't do that right away. Right away, what he did was he told him a story. And the story was about himself, King Puchinibhari. He just gave him a different name. Once upon a time, there was a king. And the king's name was Puranjana. And Puranjana was loved by his citizens. He gave all his glories and glories and wonderful, wonderful situation. But there was a problem. He didn't have a queen. So he went searching here and searching there, trying to find a suitable queen. It's kind of like a song. Couldn't find her. Couldn't find his gal. But then one wonderful day he was walking by a garden and saw in the garden a very beautiful woman who was bouncing a ball. And her bodily movements are described. Sannyasis don't need to read that too carefully. And he became attracted to this woman. And later on, Narada is describing the allegory of who the woman was. The woman was material intelligence. To be an enjoying materialist, you need material intelligence. Without material intelligence, you can't enjoy. Material intelligence is to help people enjoy. That's what education is for. To train up your material intelligence so you can make arrangements so people can enjoy, so you can get a job. To help people enjoy something. That's what the program is. So material intelligence is very much lauded in this world because it makes arrangements for sense gratification. But spiritual intelligence doesn't come about the same way and it doesn't have the same function. Spiritual intelligence is how to get to Krishna. Tadami buddhi yogam tam yena mam upiyanti te. That's what spiritual intelligence is for. Discerning the soul, discerning the goal of life, discerning how to perform and practice life in such a way the goal of life is reached. That's spiritual intelligence. And Krishna gives it. And if Krishna doesn't give it, you can't get it. You can't get it at a Walmart. You can't get it at a university. You can't get it on the street. You have to get it from Krishna. And he gives it to Tesham Satata Yuktanam Bhajatam Priti Purvakam Tatami Bodhi Yogam Tam Yenamam Upiyanti Te. So that's Srimad Bhagavatam is describing King Puchinibhari. Through this allegory, he was able to understand that his material intelligence was entangling him in desires for material enjoyment, fruitive enjoyment through his fruitive activities. And it got really complicated in the course of that long allegorical tale. And in fact, because when he died, he was attached to his queen in his next life, he became a female, another body in that form which he was attached to. And so on, the allegory continues. So the message of even in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita, even the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, is to become singularly attached to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We may use our capacity for work, our tendency for work, our inclination, born of our psychophysical nature. That's fine. Krishna doesn't say give it up. Krishna says that it is to be used, it must be used, but in the right consciousness. For engaging, we were discussing this morning from the third canto Bhagavatam, engaging that which is Krishna's energies, his extensive energies, in Krishna's service. And one who becomes spirited, like enthusiastic in that way, they can actually see all things as Krishna's energies meant for his service. There are lots of manifestations of Krishna's energy that are being misused in some other way, and that implicates people who do that in the laws of bondage, karma. Thus, knowing oneself to be transcendental to material senses, mind, and intelligence, O mighty Arjuna, one should steady the mind by deliberate spiritual intelligence, Krishna consciousness, and thus, by spiritual strength, conquer this insatiable enemy known as lust. Just today, someone was asking, my mind, how do I control the mind? So here's some very clear indication in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita. There are regulations of both mind and senses, but ultimately it's by spiritual strength. When spiritual strength, here's a, I think I discussed this yesterday. When your immune system, your strength is good, you can be exposed to some disease and not contract the disease. Some devotees ask Prabhupada, if there's a disease, an illness going around, a flu or something going around, and one person gets and another person doesn't get that illness, that flu, that disease, is that because of karma? That was the question. And Prabhupada's answer was, one whose resistance is strong will not contract the disease. One whose resistance is weak will contract the disease. He was a very short answer. And I've heard him give that answer on a number of occasions, not just one occasion. So I heard it when he was speaking in Mauritius. I think I mentioned this. He had a yellow fever injection because he was in Mauritius, and apparently there was an epidemic of yellow fever going around. So he took, medical practitioner came, and he said it was painful. The injection was painful, but it's to prevent something more painful. To make resistance strong, so if exposed to the yellow fever, you don't contract it. Spiritually, if we become strong in Krishna consciousness, we can move about the material world and not be infected by the modes of nature, which is abundantly everywhere. You can go into the workplace, you can go into the marketplace, you can go here and there. You can be sitting in your temple room chanting japa, and the modes of nature aren't going to affect you when you're chanting japa. That's nice, huh? So that's by absorption and gaining spiritual strength due to that absorption. There's no alternative to investing consciousness or being attentive to the holy name and being attentive to, as Krishna is saying here, to his injunctions, to his instructions, to the methods of regulating the mind and senses to bring us to that position where we're not infected or affected by lust, the mode of passion, or anger, the mode of ignorance, the younger brother of lust, because they have the same mother. The younger brother is anger. Kamesha, Krodesha, Rajoguna, that's the mother that gives birth to both Kama and Krodha. So withdrawing, that's the section, withdrawing oneself from that contact with the mode of passion that says, I want to enjoy. Spiritually speaking, that's natural for the soul. But what's the standard of enjoyment or the method of enjoyment? The real happiness of the soul is to be in relation, a loving relation with the Supreme. That's real happiness. That's the standard of real happiness. Loving service to Krishna. Just simply serving Krishna. In this circumstance, that circumstance, whatever the circumstance, simply serving Krishna. In a humble mood. Very happy position. Naturally happy position. So that spiritual conception is required. Otherwise, we'll have our struggles in Krishna consciousness, trying to be happy with a material conception in Krishna consciousness. They don't go well together. Therefore, we have Bhagavad Gita to help us with establishing proper conceptions, and we have the chanting of the holy name to help purify the heart so that when we read Bhagavad Gita or hear Krishna's messages, they go inside. And we can live with them and abide by them and be guided always with a pure heart, guided according to the instructions Krishna gives. Okay, so I'll end there and see if there's any discussion. Questions? Sachi's got a smile, but I don't think she's got a question. Okay, we'll end there. No? Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
His Holiness Prabhupada Swami Maharaj ki jai.
Thanksgiving weekend?
Yeah. Okay. So I think you will be coming from Japan retreat again.
I certainly will. How about you?
Yeah, I will be there. So, but I cannot attend all your lectures this week because I'm going to India tomorrow.
Tomorrow?
Yeah.
Tomorrow?
Yeah, India. Yes.
Really? How long are you going for?
3 weeks.
Okay.
So I'll be back on 30th of May.
Okay. I'll be back for the retreat.
Yeah, but
looking forward to it, I think.
Yeah, sure. My brother in Virginia.
Yeah?
Your brother? Who's your brother? Actually, this time when he was here,
hey. Otherwise, picnic.